Our speaker today who I'm glad to mention is a law school classmate of mine is Mr. J.F. Chaffley, Jr. of the Illinois Bar. He is a practicing lawyer in his own firm in Elton, Illinois, graduated from Georgetown University of Washington, D.C. in 1930, the Harvard Law School in 1933. He has been active for many years in the American Bar Association and was active in preparing the most recent report on this subject of the American Bar Association's Special Committee on Communist Tactics, Strategy, and Objectives. He was the draftsman of the so-called Brown Report of the American Bar Association on this subject. Now, Mr. Schlafly's topic today, as announced, is 5 years of the Warren Court. This is exactly the same topic as the one upon which we were addressed last August by Mr. Edward Bennett Williams of Washington, D.C. As you all know, the Commonwealth Club of California marches forward under the banner, Get the Facts, including a statement of all points of view, without necessarily disagreeing or agreeing with the subject matter and conclusions drawn by the speaker. It is a great pleasure today, then, to listen to Mr. Schlafly on this familiar topic, 5 years of the Warren Court. Mr. Schlafly.
Thank you, Alvin Rockwell, members of the Commonwealth Club, and guests. A few of us here are old enough to recall a popular World War I song which described a mother's reaction when she first saw her rookie son marching on the parade ground. The song was entitled, Everybody is Out of Step But Jim. Well, according to the Warren Court majority, the FBI is out of step, the House Un-American Activities Committee, the California Un-American Activities Committee, the Ohio Un-American Activities Committee are all out of step. The Senate Internal Security and Government Operations Committees are out of step in questioning communists. The State Department Loyalty Review Board is out of step in firing security risks. The California and New Mexico Boards of Bar Examiners are out of step in asking would-be lawyers about communist activities. The states of New York and New Hampshire are out of step in asking public school teachers about communist activities. The American Immigration and Passport Officers are out of step in trying to stop the ingress and egress of communists. The anti-subversion laws of 42 states are out of step. The interpretation given to the Smith Act by the Supreme Court in the past is out of step. The Department of Justice and the federal district and appellate judges are out of step. The executive branch of our government and the Congress are out of step. According to the Warren majority, the new version of the old World War I song seems to be, everybody is out of step but supporters of communist causes and their attorneys. In the Donald Cole case, the Warren majority ruled that supporters of communist causes could not be fired from non-sensitive government jobs. But in the John Stewart Service case, the Warren majority ruled that a man who had clandestine meetings with a Soviet espionage agent and who was too much of a security risk for even Dean Acheson to retain could not be fired from a sensitive State Department position. As a result of these decisions, the New York Times reported on July 11, 1958, that more than 300 government employees who had been fired for being security risks would have to be reinstated with back pay. Judge Robert Morris, for many years chief counsel to the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, stated, quote, "Just imagine the damage that 300 security risks can work on the security of this country." In the Nelson case, the Warren majority decided that Pennsylvania could not punish a Pennsylvania communist who had helped to organize the theft of our military secrets for violating Pennsylvania's laws against sedition, for the alleged reason that sedition was also punishable by the federal government under the Smith Act. This decision paralyzed enforcement of the sedition. This decision paralyzed enforcement of the sedition and subversion laws of 42 states, Alaska, and Hawaii. In the cases involving Yates and the other California communists, the Warren majority ruled that communists who were teaching sedition and the violent overthrow of our government, even with evil intent, could not be punished under the Smith Act. Also, that all organizing work for the Communist Party ceased in 1945, which gave the communist recruiters the benefit of the statute of limitations. This decision caused the release of more than 70 convicted communists. In reluctantly freeing 11 of these convicted communists, Federal Judge Richard Chambers of your own Court of Appeals said that this Supreme Court decision, quote, "leaves the Smith Act as to any further prosecution under it a virtual shambles," end quote from Judge Chambers. In freeing six top Michigan communists, Federal Judge Picard said, quote, "I do this very reluctantly because the Supreme Court and I disagree." J. Edgar Hoover testified on January 16, 1958, that a top communist described the Supreme Court's decision in the Yates case, quote, "as the greatest victory the Communist Party in America has ever received." In the Watkins, Flaxer, and Raley cases, the Warren majority held that neither the House Un-American Activities Committee, nor the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, nor the Ohio Un-American Activities Committee could ask witnesses to tell about their communist activities or to produce their communist records, even though these witnesses did not take the Fifth Amendment. 2 days after these Warren majority decisions were announced, the official communist newspaper, The Daily Worker, rejoiced, quote, "The court delivered a triple-barreled attack on the Department of Justice and its Smith Act trials, on the freewheeling congressional inquisitions, and the hateful loyalty security program of the executive. The curtain is closing on one of our worst periods," end quote from communist paper. In the Slocar case, the Warren majority decided that teachers in public schools could not be fired for taking the Fifth Amendment when asked about communist activities, and in the Sweezy case that it was an infringement of academic freedom even to ask a teacher these questions, quote, "Do you believe in communism? Did you advocate Marxism?" The Supreme Court has made it just as difficult for a school to get rid of a pro-communist teacher as it has for our country to get rid of pro-communist labor leader Harry Bridges. In a Subversive Activities Control Board case, the Warren majority refused to uphold the validity of the Internal Security Act of 1950, and the communists have been able to block enforcement of this law for 8 long years. Deputy Customs Collector at New York, Irving Fishman, testified the result of this decision, 500,000 pieces of foreign communist propaganda are being sent each month to American colleges. If the Warren majority had upheld the validity of the Internal Security Act, all such propaganda would have had to be stamped, quote, "disseminated by a communist organization." In the Konigsberg case, the Warren majority held that California had to issue a license to practice law to a man who refused to answer this question, "Mr. Konigsberg, are you a communist?" In the Centner and Witchkovitz cases, the Warren majority ruled that our government could not prevent aliens awaiting deportation from engaging in communist activities, nor even question these aliens about their communist activities. In the Weldon-Dayton passport case, the Warren majority ruled the State Department had to issue a passport to a research physicist who, according to the New York Times, quote, "had been present several times when secret government documents had been microfilmed for transference to the Soviet Union by Julius Rosenberg and members of his spy ring, end quote from New York Times. And even though Dayton was going to work abroad with a communist who had recently renounced his American citizenship. As a result of this decision, 702 American communists and pro-communists demanded passports, and 642 of them are now equipped with all the prestige conferred by a USA passport. Security officers believe that some of these men are going to attend the Leningrad Espionage School for graduate work in industrial and military spying, transmission of secret messages, use of agitators, etc. State Department Security Chief Roderick O'Connor testified that these passport applicants are, quote, as clearly the enemy as were the foreign troops that shot at us in World War II. In September 1958, the Army Chief of Research and Development, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, said that Soviet technical progress was due more to, quote, success in espionage and subversion than it is to their scientific apparatus. He added, we are a country that's highly penetrated. Apropos of these decisions, J. Edgar Hoover told the American Legion National Convention, quote, to dismiss lightly the existence of a subversive threat in the United States is to deliberately commit national suicide. In some quarters, we are surely doing just that. The predecessors of the Warren Court were extremely well informed on the workings of the communist conspiracy and its clear and present danger. Chief Justice Hughes, as Secretary of State, had refused to recognize Red Russia, giving as his reasons, quote, the world we desire is a world not threatened with the destructive propaganda of the Soviet authorities and one in which there will be good faith and the recognition of obligations and a sound basis of international intercourse. Chief Justice Hughes was succeeded on the Supreme Court by Chief Justice Stone. In 1943, when the propaganda in favor of communism was at its height, Chief Justice Stone voted to denaturalize California communist William Schneiderman. And in 1945, Chief Justice Stone voted to deport Harry Bridges and gave as his reason, quote, that the finding of Bridges' membership in the Communist Party standing alone supports the deportation order. Chief Justice Stone thought that those who teach communism and who associate with communists should not be coddled by the law, and said in his opinion against the head of the Communist Party in California, William Schneiderman, quote, a man can be known by the ideas he spreads as well as by the company he keeps. Chief Justice Warren's immediate predecessor was Chief Justice Vinson, who wrote the scholarly opinion sustaining the Smith Act and the convictions under it of the top 11 American communists. In four cases, the Vinson Court upheld the right of congressional and state committees to question communists and pro-communists. In another case, Chief Justice Vinson approved the statement of Justice Jackson that the Communist Party is not a political party, but, quote, is a conspiratorial and revolutionary junta organized to reach ends and to use methods which are incompatible with our constitutional system. 100 years ago, lawyer Abraham Lincoln said that the Supreme Court's decision in the Dred Scott case was based on assumed historical facts which are really not true. Likewise, many decisions of the Warren Court are based on assumed facts which are really not true. Thus, in the Watkins case, Chief Justice Warren assumed that royal commissions did not require witnesses to answer questions and concluded, therefore, that the House Un-American Activities Committee should not. This assumed historical fact was clearly not true. Had the Chief Justice taken the trouble to read the reports of either of the two most important Royal Commission investigations, the Canadian Royal Commission, which investigated the Igor Guzenko disclosures, or the Australian Royal Commission, which investigated the Vladimir Petrov espionage ring, he would have learned, first, that royal commissions do not recognize a Fifth Amendment or privilege against self-incrimination. Second, that a royal commission is the sole judge of its own procedure, that's in quotes, and no court may interfere with its investigation. And third, also unlike congressional committees, the royal commissions can arrest witnesses and hold them in jail until they answer all questions, and have done so on a number of occasions. Another assumed historical fact, which is not true, is the statement by the Warren majority that in the decade following World War II, the House Un-American Activities Committee began, quote, a new kind of congressional inquiry unknown in prior periods of American history, end quote. Either the Warren majority forgot, or its law clerks were too young to remember, that the House Un-American Activities Committee, under Chairman Martin Dies, conducted exactly the same type of congressional inquiry from 1938 to 1944 as this committee conducted in the decade following World War II. A slight study of this committee's reports would have revealed that not only were its inquiries before and after World War II of the same kind, but that it even had the same chief investigator, the brilliant Robert Stripling. A third historical assumption of the Warren majority, which also is really not true, is the notion expressed in Sweezy, Watkins, Konigsberg, Kent, and Dayton cases that communism is, quote, mere unorthodoxy in political expression and association, end quote, which is no concern of public officials. The German Supreme Court had a similar illusion about Hitler's Nazi Party and curbed the scope of the Reichstag's investigating committees. As the 1958 report of the American Bar Association on Communist Tactics puts it, quote, as a result, the Reichstag never exposed the Nazi Party or Hitler's purges and secret police. The success of the Nazi conspiracy apparently taught the German Supreme Court a lesson. On August 17, 1957, it handed down a scholarly 375-page opinion which outlawed all activities of the communist conspiracy in West Germany. End quote. Just as footprints reveal the kind of animal which passed by, so do judicial footnotes sometimes reveal the kind of persons who have influenced the Warren majority. The 39 cases involving communism which the Warren majority has decided, 30 in favor of the position taken by the communists, cite many books and articles. But not once has the Warren majority cited any of the more than 100 classic anti-communist books and reports, books which describe in corroborated details the workings of the communist conspiracy in America. Books like Robert Stripling's The Red Plot Against America, Ben Jitlow's I Confess, Whitaker Chambers' Witness, Elizabeth Bentley's Out of Bondage, Louis Boudin's Men Without Faces, James Burnham's The Web of Subversion, Nathaniel Wiles' The Battle Against Disloyalty, E.H. Cookridge, The Net That Covers the World, and J. Edgar Hoover's Masters of Deceit. Instead, the Warren majority twice cited a British socialist as authority for depriving Congress of the power to investigate communism. In the very article cited with approval by Chief Justice Warren, this British socialist charged that congressional committees, quote, vehemently pursue men and women alleged to be un-American and verge on the rabidness of a Torquemada. At one time, it was unthinkable in American jurisprudence that the opinions of foreign socialists would be cited as a basis for American law. This is no longer true since the advent of the Warren majority. In one case, the Warren majority cited with approval a book edited by a Swedish socialist named Gunnar Myrdal and co-authored by persons who have been affiliated with 422 communist enterprises. This book, called An American Dilemma, refers on page 13 to the American Constitution as, quote, nearly a plot against the common people. One of this book's principal authors has been an active communist for many years. Another co-author has been affiliated with 104 communist enterprises. Still another co-author has been affiliated with 32 communist enterprises. no court which was informed on communism or opposed to socialism would have cited with approval this book. The Charles Evan Hughes Court, the Harlan Stone Court, the Fred Vinson Court never cited writings of socialists and communists as guides for American law. Legislation was introduced in the last Congress to restore to congressional committees the same freedom to investigate communists and pro-communists that these committees have always had to investigate businessmen and labor leaders. To restore to the states the right to enforce their own anti-subversive laws. To restore to the executive branch the right to dismiss security risks from both sensitive and non-sensitive government jobs. And to restore to the executive the right to deny passports to members of the communist conspiracy and their supporters. These legislative efforts caused some well-meaning but misguided people to say that these bills should be defeated because they would, quote, curb the court. Well, in the last 20 years, Congress has, on more than 10 occasions, passed bills which curbed or overcame the effect of what the American people thought were bad court decisions. Examples of court decisions which Congress corrected are the decision which ordered employers to pay portal-to-portal pay, the decisions which held that Tideland's oil did not belong to the states but to the federal government, the decisions that both the insurance business and intrastate gas rates should be regulated by the federal government instead of by the states, and the decision which forbade the deportation of alien communists. Another argument made against plugging the loopholes in our national security caused by the Warren majority is that the court is our national umpire, whose decisions must not be questioned. Suppose the umpire says that the home team has to tell the red team everything, as the Warren majority ruled in the Jenks case, but that the red team doesn't have to tell the home team anything, as the Warren majority ruled in the Watkins, Sweezy, Slocar, Konigsberg, Sacher, and Raley cases. Suppose the umpire says, as the Warren majority ruled in the coal and service cases, that the red players can infiltrate into the home team's huddle and even sneak men into every position on the home team except quarterback, which the umpire says is the only sensitive position on the team. And then the umpire forbids the home team to remove these reds because they are not occupying sensitive positions. Would not the fans say that the umpire is not umpiring? He is changing the rules so as to favor the red team and to prejudice the home team. We lawyers have always defended the Hughes Court, Stone Court, and the Vinson Court. We will defend the Warren Court as long as it confines itself to umpiring. Last summer, 36 chief justices of state courts reported to the American Bar Association that the Supreme Court, quote, has assumed what seemed to us primarily legislative powers, end quote, from the chief justices. When 36 distinguished umpires report that the Warren majority is no longer umpiring, but is changing the rules of the game, and Judge Leonard Hand, the Dean of Federal Judges, writes that the court has assumed, quote, the role of a third legislative chamber, end quote, then lawyers must choose between the Warren majority and the Constitution. This is because the Constitution provides that all legislative power shall be vested only in the Congress and in the state legislatures and not in the Supreme Court. 35 years ago, Lenin confidently wrote the Communist Master Plan for World Conquest. First, we will take Eastern Europe, then the masses of Asia. Then we will encircle the United States, which will be the last bastion of capitalism. We will not have to attack. It will fall like an overripe fruit into our hands. End quote from Lenin. As Lenin predicted, the communists have taken Eastern Europe. They have taken the masses of Asia. They are now trying to encircle the United States by way of South America, as was demonstrated in the Nixon riots. The San Francisco author of the Gaither Report to President Eisenhower on the threat of communism said, quote, our security is in unprecedented peril. We pray that the Warren Court will do its homework on communism. We pray that the court will then be mindful of the legal maxim, which is the official model of the state of Missouri, and which is said to have preserved the Roman Republic for centuries. Salus populi, suprema lex. The safety of the people is the supreme law.
Thank you very much, Fred Schlafly. As must be apparent from the warm applause, the members of the Commonwealth Club of California are deeply grateful to you for interrupting your short business trip to San Francisco to come here and present to us the second side of this controversial issue. And now, if you'd kindly return here to the lectern with me, there's some questions that I think some of your other classmates from the Harvard Law School may have written. You'll have your opportunity to answer them, and you'll have just the same latitude and freedom which you would have had in law school. The first one, there are two of them that I'll read for you. Are these pro-red decisions that you have referred to due to some lack of knowledge of the law or something else? And secondly, how many of the decisions which you credit to what you call the Warren majority were in effect, or actually, the decisions of the court as a whole? Were not some of these unanimous decisions of the court?
I do not recall that any of these decisions were unanimous. In most, if not all of them, there were some very vigorous dissents. Former Attorney General and now Associate Justice Tom Clark wrote some particularly biting criticisms of the majority decisions. With reference to the question as to are these pro-red decisions due to lack of knowledge of the law, as the questioner puts it, or something else, I think that it is simply due to the fact that the majority of the court is somewhat uninformed on the communist conspiracy and does not believe it is as serious as many of us think.
Now, two questions on a different topic. Probably these are written by laymen. Does the Supreme Court have the option of following the election returns? And secondly, does informed public opinion play a role in recent Supreme Court decisions?
I would prefer that my distinguished colleagues here, Alvin Rockwell and other lawyers present, including our chairman, answer these questions. I will, as to whether or not the court follows the election returns, I will pass that by. I'm not in a position to say.
Here is a broad subject. Recognizing the validity of your case, what definite concrete things can a patriotic citizen do to offset the decisions that you cite?
I would suggest giving support to the instruments of our government which are trying to combat the communist conspiracy. The FBI, the Senate Internal Security Committee, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and the Government Operations Committees. As you may realize, there is now a concerted, well-organized attack on the FBI. It led off with a bitter full-length criticism in The Nation magazine, entire issue devoted to a bitter attack on J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. I think the communist conspiracy believe that they have perhaps silenced the congressional committees, and the next target in their campaign is the FBI.
Now, two questions that are somewhat allied to the last one. First, what hope is there for the country with the present Supreme Court, and what can we do about it? And possibly this next one suggests one of your answers. Do you anticipate that Congress will employ its constitutional power to curb the court?
I do not know. There was legislation introduced, as I mentioned in my talk, to correct some of these Supreme Court decisions. Some of this legislation had a strange experience. Congressman Howard Smith introduced a bill to repeal the effect of the Nelson decision so the states could punish subversion in their own boundaries. And this bill passed the House by a very large majority. It came onto the floor of the Senate and then followed what the Eastern newspapers describe as Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson's black magic. They said that Lyndon Johnson told certain Democrats who were for the bill to vote against the bill to put Vice President Nixon on the spot so that he would have to break the tie. The actual vote came out as 41-40. And then he was supposed to have told, according to these Eastern newspapers, certain Republicans who were for the bill to vote against the bill to prevent Vice President Nixon from being on the spot. The bill was defeated 41-40. There was another bill to correct some of the decisions, which passed the House in one form, passed the Senate in another form, came to a joint Senate-House committee. The committees ironed out the differences, sent it back to the House. It passed the House, came over to the Senate, was on Senator Lyndon Johnson's desk when he called for adjournment last August.